This is the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's May 26, 1989, at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. We have a work session on Senate Bill 694, Senate Bill 966, and House Bill 2277, House Bill 2513, 2529, 2769, a public hearing on House Bill 2191, 2252A, 2469A, 3437, public hearing and possible work session on HJR 2, Senate Bill 1070, 1073, House Bill 2561, 2583, 2668, and 3365.
Raft of people, everybody signed up against.
I think we'd like to bring a panel of
sure,
three.
We'd
so
like that.
Why don't you come up with us? We can expedite the process.
Whoops. Now that you've gone through all this trouble. Giving everybody a better understanding of the system, right, Dan Welch?
That's it. Clear understanding.
Clear understanding. I thought we started out to do this.
We start out every 2 years to do this.
Madam Chair, there is an amendment that I'll pass out.
Great, thank you. Okay, Janice and company.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janice Yaden, Assistant to the Governor for Human Resources. We are here to talk about a proposal that the governor had introduced dealing with status offenders. This is one I think you've seen before, and I firmly believe you will see again. There's not complete unanimity on how these young people ought to be dealt with when they're in trouble, anywhere from little trouble to very big trouble. We had talked to a number of individuals before the proposal was drafted, and there really is, you'll find, wide varying philosophy on this issue. The governor asked Don Welch, who's the director of juvenile court services in Clackamas County, to work with the service providers to come up with a proposal that encompasses the concerns of that range of philosophies on how to deal with status offenders. He did that. That bill that was drafted, House Bill 3437, had a hearing in the House. At that time, it was obvious that that still did not have agreement with all the parties, interested parties, and there were a number of individuals who raised concerns about that bill. The House members at that time went to a work committee and came back with a set of amendments, which you now see in House Bill 3437, which substantially changed the intent and the way the bill was drafted by Mr. Welch. I want him to talk a little bit about his original concept and how this change occurred. But the underlying point here now is that I believe that the amended version has even less support than the original version did. And I think that this point, and I've talked to the governor about this, that we probably should move this issue into, once again, an interim study. Even though I'm concerned about doing that because it feels like we never ever get anywhere on this issue, and we still have a number of young people who are not being served very well under how we currently deal with status offenders in Oregon, and there's still a lot of pressures on the juvenile courts that are unrealistic given our current statutes. Nevertheless, I am not convinced at all that in a short time frame we can bring about some kind of a consensus on this issue. We have prepared and discussed with your council an amendment which would, in fact, move this into a study, an interim study, guided by the Juvenile Services Commission. The executive director is here, David Fuchs, and can talk about how that study would hopefully bring all of those elements together again in another proposal. I'm going to quit talking and let Don Welch talk just a little bit about something which I personally believe was a very exciting new concept in bringing these two philosophies together.
Madam Chairman, Don Welch, Clackamas County Juvenile Department. We, at the onset of the discussion about status offenders, came to the discussion with, among other elements to be considered, the consequences of the governor's statewide travel and the concern he heard, if not universally, broadly, that the present existing capacity of the court system to cope with status offenders frustrated essentially everyone. There was a diversity of interpretation of the statutes, but largely what you had was a circumstance in which the courts were granted jurisdiction, technically jurisdiction, but they were denied the right, the power to enforce any orders which they might draw on the basis of lack of access to detention. Almost no one was willing to go back in history to that time when status offenders, by reason of being a status offender, were thereby eligible for detention. Most of us could point to abuse, even within our own operations, sometimes myopic views of what were the issues involved in that person's life that brought them to that particular mode of behavior. And as a consequence, we entered into the consideration of the issue this time with the idea that we needed to preserve what had developed in recent years, and that is an effort by individual communities and counties to provide social services to deal with what is primarily a social phenomenon. The status offender, it's a label we use that often is not clearly understood, but essentially we're talking about people who are having significant intrafamilial problems. They're running away, they're beyond control, they're failing to follow directions, often running away because anybody with a reasonable mindset would also run from a situation which was perhaps deplorable, but not always. The social service agencies had discovered that there was always a percentage of the kids who were resistant to receiving care which was necessary to their welfare. And painfully, I believe, many of them came to the conclusion that the loss of the use of the court system, the loss of the potential for detention, had foreclosed services to a significant number of status offenders. We therefore developed a concept which made child serving agencies, specific child serving agencies, the gatekeeper for access to the court system in a selected number of cases, those cases where the agency had tried and determined that it was impossible to get the family and the child to accept services unless there was a coercive ingredient, namely the court. Therefore, as it originally drafted, 3437 created something which we called an approved social agency. That agency was, through a process I won't elaborate now on, was afforded immediate access to a child who rises in the community as a status offender, and on the basis of the interaction between that agency and the child, could or could not ask the court to interject itself. I mean a number of people who are street-serving agency people, and the court felt that it was an appropriate screening, an appropriate way of restricting the number of cases that came to a court. It was a control both on the tendency for some parents to dump kids and also a control on some courts to perhaps gather to their bosom kids that were not appropriately handled in that manner. I continue to be convinced that once and for all, Oregon needs to come to grips philosophically in terms of policy with this population. I happen to believe the original 3437 is an excellent beginning point. But in the interim, we have a dilemma, because the statute continues to say that the juvenile court does have jurisdiction. But it also continues to say that the court has no potential for enforcing that jurisdiction if the family or if the child is resistant. Given the realities of the world, the political world, the child care world, I'm in accord with the governor's position at this juncture that what we need to do is to study this issue, not so much from the standpoint that we'll have some profound truth which will emerge, because I rather doubt that's the case, but so that we can come together collectively as social service agencies, the court, and come to an understanding of how we think this committee ought to be advised to address this population. Therefore, I would submit to you the proposition that as it presently is written, A. Engrossed version of 3437 is an isolated view. It does not have the accord of any whom I know who are in the direct service area. It has, I suppose one might say the objection comes from every quarter in which I have any contact, not the least of which is that as presently written, A. Engrossed 3437 opens the door to detention for virtually any child, provides no mandate for social services, has entirely the wrong philosophical message in its roots, plus has an open-ended fiscal implication for the counties. Therefore, I'm of the view that given that the original version of 3437 is not going to be the law of the land in 1989, certainly the A. Engrossed version should not, and I would ask that you table the bill or accept the governor's amendments, which would provide for its study. My written testimony, by the way, includes significant background information on the original version. It also has objection to a couple of technical implications of the A. Engrossed version, which are incidental to its thrust, but significant in terms of its negative influence on dependency and neglect jurisdiction and other matters. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shoemaker.
To what extent was the original version the product of a study such as is now being again suggested?
I would not, Senator, I wouldn't use the word study. What we did was to come up with a concept, and I must say that was essentially in vacuum, and expose to people who were in the service area, to the Juvenile Services Commission, certainly to the governor's office, this concept of the mix I described, and on the basis of the reactions from those quarters, generated the bill.
So you think that maybe a study would give some additional bona fides to the original proposal, perhaps?
I believe it would do that. More than that, Senator, I think it would give people an opportunity who are on different sides of the issue to debate those sides and come to a meeting of the minds.
Which may have that.
Yes.
Other questions? Thank you very much. David?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Fuchs, Executive Director of the Oregon Juvenile Services Commission. I'll be very brief. The Juvenile Services Commission and the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee also do not support this bill. In its original form, we were more or less supportive of the work that Mr. Welch undertook on the governor's behalf. There was a good deal of contention in the original discussion that we had, and it's interesting now that there is unanimity about this bill, but is unanimous agreement that this is not the vehicle that's going to solve the problem of those few status offenders who are so far out of control that that the court is the appropriate last resort. Unfortunately, this opens the gate wide enough that it takes us a giant step backwards in terms of how we deal with high-risk young people in the community, and we're very concerned about it. We are supportive of the amendments put forward by the governor's office. The Juvenile Services Commission is willing to take on the responsibility for convening the appropriate parties, both legislators and members of the juvenile justice system, to come together and discuss this issue through the next biennium and hopefully come forward in 1991 with a piece of legislation that's acceptable. In closing, I just want to say it's critical that as we plan for status offenders that we recognize that these young people are not criminals. They're kids that are running away from dysfunctional families, from sometimes from their own emotional problems. The issue for status offenders is more often how do we deliver appropriate services in the community than it is how do we detain those young people. And if detention is used inappropriately, what it does is it creates more stress on an overburdened juvenile detention system, which is dealing with more serious offenders that are out in the community and who need those sanctions considerably more than most status offenders will. So we look forward to doing this work and would be glad to take it on.
Okay, can I ask a question? Assuming that the bill doesn't pass, will you, as a Juvenile Services Commission, set about doing this regardless of whether we actually get a bill from us, from you?
Yes.
Guess that's the basic question.
Yes.
Because my version of how this might all work, yes, fine, we'd adopt the amendments. The House decides not to concur, and you have a dead bill anyway. So I'm wondering whether we ought just to plain table the bill now and not take up either legislative time or your time in trying to convince anybody else that we ought to fight in a conference committee or decide to concur or not concur with Senator
Bennett. That would not be a problem from our vantage point.
Senator Springer.
Well, like the chair, I think got a little history on this subject going back to 1981 when we visited these subjects in some detail. I'm not going to go through all that with you. Many of you probably know more about it than I do. But my question to you, David, is I need to know about how this group is going to be constituted so I can be sure it's not going to be a stacked deck or people are going to come to this with some effort to keep an open mind on the subject, or it's going to be a fairly broad-based and that all interests are going to be represented.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, we want this to be a wide-open process. What I want to avoid in 91 when we come forward with a new proposal is a sense that people didn't feel that they had a chance to participate in the discussion and that we haven't achieved, as close as we can, a real consensus among the concerned parties. So we're going to make every effort to assure that all points of view are heard and participate in the discussion.
Well, I'll just underscore, if that for some reason isn't the case, you're just wasting your time, because I'm not even listening in 91 if I don't feel that it's been exactly as you've assured us it's going to be. Thank you.
Chair.
I appreciate that.
Senator Grinsky.
Maybe I'm missing something, but this bill has already passed the House. Is there some reason something's changed since it came from over there that means we shouldn't even be looking at it now?
Mm-hmm. All these people have signed up in opposition to the bill as it came from the House. They are generally the original people who worked on the original bill.
They changed their mind or something new?
No, the House amended it severely.
Okay.
Fatally, I think is the word.
Fatally. Or changed direction, I guess.
From the original bill?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear quickly from Muriel Goldman, Charles Ryer, and Steve Cafori.
Senator Cohen.
Yes.
Muriel Goldman probably is not here yet. I brought her written testimony and have submitted that for her.
Good.
Representing the Juvenile Advisory Council, Multnomah County.
Good. Thank you. And we have a long agenda, so I don't want to take a lot of time with this bill, but we'll
thank you.
Want to get people on the record. Thank you. Who's going to go first? Charles?
Thank you, Senator. My name is Charles Ryer, the Assistant Director of the Lane County Juvenile Department. We're also speaking on behalf of the Lane County Board of Commissioners in opposition to this bill. Don Welch has already spoken to the substantive issues involved and state on those points only that the Board of Commissioners of Lane County is in concurrence with Don's analysis of those substantive issues and the recommendations made to this committee. I would only like to underscore the county's additional concerns with the fiscal problems that are associated with this piece of legislation. Skipworth Juvenile Home, which is our detention center, is in a daily struggle to remain within its bed space capacity. To add an additional class of persons to that potential group of detainees would require capital construction, additional staff, food, bedding. That would be a substantial expense that the county is not in a position to absorb. The alternative to that is to deny access to that group of people, notwithstanding the legislation, and thereby simply produce an illusion to the public that there is a service available. So we would certainly urge, for those additional reasons, that this bill be tabled.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we agree with the previous speaker.
Madam Chair, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm representing the Oregon Conference of Private Child Caring Agencies, which is a group of residential care facilities for children who are abused, neglected, delinquent, abandoned, whatever, emotionally disturbed. A lot of these kids that we have are the kind of young people that we've been talking about today. If Senator Springer thinks it goes back to 1981, let me assure him that Don Welch and I sat here during the early 70s and went through the same process, and I don't think it's ever going to end. I don't think there's going to be unanimity agreed. I think the best thing we can hope to work upon is some kind of compromise. To that end, I'm concerned about a group of people who are not legislators going out and coming back with a solution and trying to sell it to the legislature. The one advantage of an interim study is that you have people who are going to be making those decisions at the end of the line involved in the process, which is why I think it might be worth amending to, as per the governor's suggestion, in making interim study it, so that we do have that buy-in.
Appreciate your comments, Steve.
Yeah, well, I want to just very briefly make one other statement. There is one concern that we have that sometimes the line between who is a status offender and who is a juvenile delinquent depends on what happens the day that that person is picked up and whether the court and the prosecutor decide that they want to treat that child as a juvenile offender or as a status offender. We would like to have the state realize that when the state picks these kids up and puts them into a private home like we have, and the state is paying for them, that they are state children, and that if there is going to be some kind of detention for these kids, that the state has a responsibility. The counties, as you've heard, and we'll hear from other counties, do not have the money to provide those services. And if we expect that somehow the state legislature is going to set up a structure and then drop it on the counties and ask them to provide services, it will not happen. And that's another reason, Madam Chair, for having the state legislature be involved in the studies, because there will be state fiscal implications.
Okay, Steve, I want you to look at the amendments now. I don't see there's very much state involved. Are you suggesting that the Juvenile Services Commission is an appropriate interim committee that's sort of out enough, or are you suggesting that it is a effort of the interim judiciary committee itself as a study? I just need some clarification as to your comments
if there are,
to this amendment.
Madam Chair, if there are legislators in that process, that would, I think, be a good idea. If not, I would like to see a regular interim study through the Interim Judiciary Committee. My point is twofold. I think in order to have a buy-in by legislators, they have to be part of the process. Secondarily, I think the state has to realize that it's going to be state money paying for these kids. There is no alternative, frankly. And we can pass all the laws we want to, suggesting what the counties ought to do, but unless the state buys into it to the point they're willing to put money into it, we're playing games.
Thank you for the comments. Questions? Paul.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's just hold this bill over then, and we'll see whether we're going to end up tabling it or sending it out as a study, or whether this appropriate version of the draft is appropriate. I'm happy to do whatever the committee. Do we have it as a work? Is it scheduled as a possible?
Scheduled work session.
Possible. Oh, it's scheduled for public hearing. No, it isn't. Okay, well, let's wait and take a look at the language to make sure the study is drafted appropriately if we want to go ahead, and I'll poll the committee before we take it up again. Thank you. Catherine is here. Take up Senate Bill 694. If you recall, Senate Bill 694 was taken out of this committee, and on the way to the desk, it brought to our attention that there was an amendment that the committee staff in the Human Resources Committee had failed to attach to the bill as it came to us. And rather than send it back to Human Resources Committee or send it over to the House in its defective form, The carrier of the bill and the people in whom Resources Committee asked that we bring it back since it hadn't gotten to the desk and adopt the amendments which are now being handed out to you. They're A7 amendments, and this bill has to do testing with laboratories and the permitting of laboratories and the types of activities that they do in a clinical laboratory, etc. So I would move the A-7 amendments to Senate Bill 694. And Catherine, I don't need to go through. I just think what we need to do is make sure that the amendments are appropriately fitted into the bill according to your review.
They are, Senator. And Senator Kenemer and the people who originally proposed it have reviewed it and said it was consistent with the conceptual amendment adopted by the other committee.
Right. So we're doing a little housekeeping here for other committees, and we have, in fact, passed this bill out once already. Are there objections to the A-7 amendments as Chair has offered to Senate Bill 694? Hearing none. So ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 694 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Pat.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much, folks, for your courtesy. Senate Bill 966. We have been directed, folks.
Is it the stomach gave you?
Right. This bill deals with the asbestos abatement and allowing certain educational facilities to come under to have 2 years to file their claims, I think, in federal court. Catherine?
The -4 amendments that you have in front of you extend the statute of limitations from 2 years for property damages against the manufacturer, distributor, seller of asbestos products or asbestos if the action is commenced by the owner of a private, nonprofit, elementary or secondary school. Basically, it's opening a 2-year window which starts at the time of the effective date of the act. The bill also defines what a school is, and it applies specifically to causes of action already arisen before the effective date of the act.
It is -4 amendments that have come to you to, I think, clarify it, and it is straightforward. It is a straightforward bill. We had some testimony from the Portland School District last time from members who had missed that, and they felt that it didn't interfere in their activity, that it was a clear-cut bill, and we also had some testimony from a private attorney who helped us go through the details of what it is and what they're trying to do. Senator Springer, have you looked at the amendments?
Yes, ma'am.
Like
I'm ready to move
here?
The -4 amendments.
Okay. Senator Springer has moved Senate Bill 966-4. Discussion.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I fully understand this yet. Let me see if I have it straight. The bill, as before those amendments, effectively opened up the statute of limitations without limit.
Yes.
In other words, it was just open forever.
And for every, and in this, and in one of those, for, is it sub B, also for a whole broader public,
right.
Almost anybody.
Almost anybody.
Right.
So. Then that's all taken out.
Right.
Civil action for property damage.
Catherine might respond, tell you exactly what it does, in fact.
Catherine?
If you're looking for the time period on the statute, it starts on line, the end of line 8, and it's for 2 years after the effective date of the act.
And then it would be closed for private, nonprofit, elementary, or secondary school buildings. Be closed, right?
Right, they can no longer take a cause of action after that time.
Any of them, whether or not they've discovered the asbestos by this time or anything. It just says, well, you, if you haven't, you should have.
Okay, now, no, not should have. They come under federal law, as well as the public schools, to have developed a plan by 19 April of '89. So they are included in the federal act of having to investigate the buildings, come up with a plan, et cetera, et cetera. So they come under the federal law with having to act, and they do have the same deadline as the public schools, is my understanding and testimony from Mr. Slater. So what we're doing here is allowing them to kind of have their chance at a lawsuit when the public schools have no statute of limitations at all, according to court ruling.
Okay. I was not able to be here at the last hearing on this. I think there have been two hearings so far, have there not?
Yes.
These amendments are just being introduced today, right?
No.
Were they discussed at the last hearing?
We've gone through that question. I want them to restate it for you. Why is this different than the issue of stale evidence? And in a few words, if you would just describe what the witnesses went through so that Senator Shoemaker can understand what the testimony was.
I'm not relating to the bill as originally engrossed, the abuser himself. I understand that, and I'm quite agreeable with that. I'm concerned with this amendment, which extends the statute for those who are only collaterally involved in the offense and who may have been a teacher or a superintendent in an institution when something like this went on, and now you're bringing him into court. It could be like 20 years after the offense occurred, and it's going to be very hard for that person to respond appropriately to the complaint. Much harder for him, it seems to me, than for the offender himself. So I'm troubled at extending this
him?
To these collateral.
Who's the him? I think the him is the institution.
The him is the abuser, and you don't have a problem with the abuser.
Right.
In addition, it's the institution, right?
Or any other person who might have been involved in it, if I read this correctly.
Well, if they were directly involved as a person, then they were an abuser.
Well, you could have one of the spouses, perhaps, I suppose, allowing, permitting, or encouraging, that getting pretty close, but allowing or permitting is sort of suffering it to happen. That, I suppose, could occur somebody who could involve a person who was involved in the relationship and somehow and might have been able to prevent it but didn't. That person could be brought in if there is... You know, if there's negligence involved there, that person could be brought in, and this would extend the statute on that person.
If I may, Madam Chair.
I'm troubled.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker.
Your name, please.
I'm Stephen Taylor, also from Mr. McMiniman's office, an associate of Mr. Williams here. Again, to restate for Senator Shoemaker's benefit, we represent a number of victims in this situation. One of the recurring themes that we see in those cases is not only the abuse by the person who is physically involved, but active concealment by others. And specifically, one of the people who was here to testify the other day is a young woman who is the daughter of a minister who has admitted to abusing over 250 children during the course of his ministry and in that capacity. The evidence that we are developing in her case is that, and I should point out that this statute would not apply to her case simply because she was too old. The evidence that is developing there is that there was an active concealment by the church. It knew from the time that he was in the seminary that he was a pedophile. It was put on notice at a later date, and it actively moved, our contention is that it actively moved him around to hide the fact. That's the kind of active events that we're seeking to remedy here. The problem is, the reason that specifically the statute of limitations should be changed in that event, is that those events to cover up the acts are while this person is typically a child.
I understand that case, but let me pose this case to you then.
Certainly.
An institution that could be seen in the benefit of hindsight to have been negligent in not supervising the offender more carefully, that there were signs that this person was misbehaving in this fashion, and the institution arguably should have seen that and should have intervened, but it didn't, and it allowed this offense to go on. And that, and then time passes, and 20 years later, that institution, along with that person, is sued. The evidence coming in from the plaintiff is probably pretty clear, because that plaintiff has been carrying it around for all that time, and with the aid of good counsel, could put on a pretty strong case. The defendant in that case, who was not an active participant or not an act, did not actively try to conceal, but may have been negligent in its duty, would have a dickens of a time defending that, and that's what troubles me.
Madam Chair, may I respond to Senator Shoemaker's concern?
Sure, please.
I think one of the scenarios that you've suggested, I'm sure, is something that immediately does leap to mind when you worry about perhaps the rights of the innocent defendant or the one who has been drug into this without any involvement or complacency on the institution or the individual's own part. But the reality of the situation is, from the plaintiff's perspective, we have a burden of even trying to decide whether we're going to be able to meet our burden of proof to keep that individual in the case. And it certainly is not an allegation that would be made frivolously or without some reason to believe that the institution or the other individuals collateral to the abuser were involved, had knowledge, and allowed, permitted, or encouraged the child abuse. It's not only foolhardy from a practice point of view, it's also financially foolhardy, because you end up, no doubt, with an additional defendant raising the all the defenses available to the parties in the proceeding. I also believe that we're making a public policy statement here, and that basically is what this whole bill comes down to. The state of Oregon, through the legislature, is being asked to state a position on what has the greater priority, the rights of those individuals who were abused as children, or the potential difficulty that an individual defendant may have in amassing a defense some years after the event. And I think on that ground alone, had you heard the testimony of the witnesses who spoke on Wednesday, I believe it would have been an overwhelming consensus that the public policy decision has to be to give those individuals at least the right to bring the cause of action. Bringing the cause of action is not going to mean that a frivolous case is going to result in adjudication in favor of the plaintiff. It simply gives the plaintiff that right.
Well, we have two members here, and I'm not, you know, we're wasting time to argue when we don't have the rest of the committee members here, and we're obviously can't.
Well, except that my vote, I don't know if my vote's needed or not, but I'm, as I stand now, I'm not going to vote in favor of the amendment.
Okay, well, that's fair.
I will vote in favor of the bill.
But sitting here talking about it
doesn't
do us any good when we've got a room full of witnesses.
Okay.
And that's all my point
all right.
is. Because, you know, and if people need to convince you, they now know on what basis
they
need to
convince. They now know
who they
need to talk to.
And that's what this
okay.
is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Braun is probably gone now.
Doesn't want the bill, huh?
Well, no. Catherine, did you, excuse me, I need to, you said 2769 was missed, is that it? And the witnesses left, it was on, that was okay, we just forgot to call it. Okay, we don't have enough votes to take that up right now. Okay.
Do you want me to watch, and if more people come down,
okay. Let's move ahead then to 1073 and get through the Criminal Justice Council amendments. 1073. So we have Judge Yaragwan, who's come from afar. We have Mr. Sullivan, who was going to be here at 2, and I think came. He's here. Kathleen, Bob, whoever you're going to bring up, that would be great.
That's what
Madam Chair, I'm passing out some amendments to the A and Gross version that I've received from the Criminal Justice Council.
Thank you. 10-7-3, folks.
10-7-3.
It is the chair's intention that after we have scheduled public hearings, full public hearings on the rules and this bill, we'll get it. It would be my choice to adopt the amendments today. And I have testimony on, along with the rules, on next week, Wednesday. We have a joint hearing with this, with the House Committee in the afternoon on Wednesday, and then plan to pass this bill out next Friday. So here we are, Kathleen and Bob and company.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kathleen Bogan, I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Council. With me is Bob Durston of the council staff and Judge Frank Uragwin, Circuit Court Judge from Malheur and Harney counties, and an associate member of the council who's worked on guidelines. I have a distributed to you today. There is a new set of amendments, which I think council just distributed. My proposed way to proceed, Judge Uragwin has some opening comments that he would like to make. Then my proposal was to just simply go through the engrossed bill, indicate to you the council's amendments, which were included in the handout today and the former -9 amendments, and tell you where those amendments fall. And I'm also prepared, I think we're now up to -13 on the amendments submitted by other parties, to give you the council's and the board's position on those amendments.
Sure.
If that makes sense as a way to go ahead, then I'd let Judge Uragwin begin. And
Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, in 1977, I became a member of what was called the Advisory Commission on Parole Standards and Guidelines. Mm-hmm. No. I'm the only remaining member now that went on in 1977. We were responsible for developing the parole matrix. It became very apparent within a very short period of time that structuring output or release really was not the way to process inmates in Oregon, at least in my view. We were doing that to attempt to give some sort of structure to the process so far as the use of resources, but also primarily to reduce disparity. We accomplished that, but resources simply did us in. It became very apparent that we needed some sort of process up front that would involve commitments. So in the early 1980s, I became committed personally to some sort of structured judicial discretion. And Senator Springer can recall in the early 1980s being involved in an endeavor where we were both rather ripped with that sort of a concept. I think it is something that has been needed in Oregon for many, many years, and we are just getting to the point now of doing something that we should have done in the early 1980s. So far as what we've gone through in developing these particular guidelines, I don't think there is anyone that has worked on them that can say, I accept everything that's within these guidelines without question. It's gone all the way from broad policy decisions in Oregon down to minute wording. And there isn't a one of us that wouldn't be able to point to several particulars and say, I really personally don't like this. The only thing I can say is, though, we have attempted to do a lot of balancing of policies and differing viewpoints and come up with some sort of a way to begin to structure this particular process. Our bill that we're presenting to you is the result of that particular work. I think that we could readily become bogged down in a lot of arguments over some of the particulars, any one of us. But again, the way I've tried to approach it with the judges and in general is, we've got to do something. We're way behind in doing that, and at least this is getting us into an area that we should have been in some time ago. Thank you.
Thanks, Judge. Other questions? Judge Uragwin.
Madam Chair, I would just thank the judge for his efforts over the years. I recall well that work during the '81 and '83 interim, and I'd like to think we laid some of the groundwork and began what has become an important evolution, I think, in thinking and acceptance in the criminal justice system for these sentencing guidelines. And note, there's a third person here, Ms. Zuckerman, who also did a tremendous amount of work at that time. Thank you.
Which was not very well received at that time.
Yes, some of us also know that. Chair was here then, too.
That's right.
I avoided it.
Next, whoever's here.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1073, the A engrossed version, is before you. It is the set of statutory amendments and some new language which will make the guidelines work. I understand committee counsel has asked that this count as 40 bills for the criminal side so that it evens the tally with the civil side.
It was 40? It was 60.
It is not as formidable a bill as it may look. I do think that at least 50% of this is technical language that is simply conforming language. What I'd like to do is take you through it very briefly, section by section. I'll flag for you where there is new language, where there is a substantive change, where it's technical, and if you show you where the amendments that we're proposing fall, and then if you have questions, we'll do our best to answer them. When we get to the appellate review section, I am going to ask Ed Sullivan to join us. He's another associate member of the council, and chaired Governor Straub's Corrections Task Force in 75, 76, even before the '83 session. So, the A engrossed bill, section 2 of the A engrossed bill, the first substantive section of the bill, is new language that relates to how plea negotiations are going to work under guidelines. We are proposing at line 12 that language be inserted right there that says, whenever a plea agreement is presented to the sentencing judge, all of this language is before you, counsel, in either the draft 9 or the document today.
This document incorporates the draft 9?
I will be including in the walkthrough the draft 9 amendments as well as the amendments put forward today.
What do we look at to correlate all this?
Senator, you should have in front of you the A engrossed bill.
Got that.
The document that I've just handed out.
Got that.
Recommended amendments sentencing.
And then my third hand, I need the dash 9 amendments.
And then you also have your amendment file that should be tagged appropriately. Which would be dash 9.
What do those tags mean? Oh, okay.
Senator Shoemaker, if I were you, I think I would look at the A engrossed bill.
I'll just take your word for it.
And I'll promise to go as slowly as I can through the language. There aren't any big chunks of new language. I can only do it by engrossing one for myself. And section 2 has to do with pleas. The language that we're proposing to amend is simply adding in, to make it clear, at page 1, line 12, that it has to do with when a plea agreement is presented to the judge, the following will happen. At line 19, we're deleting subject to subsection 1. Page 2 of the bill, we are proposing to add at line 8, the judge is allowed to accept a plea agreement for a departure sentence. We want to add in, under the guidelines, there are optional probationary sentences. There are boxes where a sentence can be either probation or prison without a departure. We want to add in there, the judge may accept an agreement for an optional probationary sentence or a departure sentence. Section 4 of the bill is also new language. It has to do with pleading and proof in a post-guidelines age. The guidelines, the structure of the guidelines provides that certain offenses can occur in more than one crime seriousness classification. Burglary, property crimes, other crimes can be at crime category 7 or 8 or 9 depending upon the elements of the crime. Those elements that make those distinctions in the guidelines are different from the elements that are spelled out in the current statutes. It's the position of the board that State versus Quinn requires that for a conviction to include anything other than the lowest criminal history crime seriousness classification, that the elements which would contribute to the higher crime seriousness classification have to be pleaded and proven. State versus Quinn is the death penalty case. It cites as precedent a number of cases that are not death penalty cases. And what it says basically is that facts that go to the punishment for the offense have to be found by the jury. Okay. I think this is a point of some concern for the district attorneys. My suggestion is that if these are not pleaded and proven at trial, that the appellate court will decide whether that's necessary. It was the board's position that they thought probably it was going to be necessary. They erred on the side of preserving the higher convictions by requiring those elements to be pleaded and proven. It's a long explanation for a short section, but it's a controversial section. Section 5 is present law. It simply requires that at the time the district attorney makes disclosure to the defendant of names of witnesses, they will disclose all prior convictions, which will have to do with the criminal history scoring system. Section 6 is existing law. It's amended to provide the effective date for the guidelines. They will be applied in sentencing for all felonies after September 1st, 1989. On page 13, at line 25, we are proposing in the amendments presented today to make clear that in sentencing under the guideline system, the court will be required to complete a sentencing form. The form is to be forwarded to the Criminal Justice Council. There is a time frame. It is 4 working days. Basically, we'd like the courts to batch these once a week and send them on to the council. This is to require the court to relay information to the council about the conviction, the offense, any aggravating and mitigating factors which may occur. Section 7 of the bill is coupled with the language I just gave you, authorizes the board to provide the form of that rule, the form, to set out what information will be required on the sentencing form that will be forwarded to the Criminal Justice Council. The board will do it by rule. They'll consult with the Department of Corrections and the State Court Administrator. We're proposing at line 44 an amendment that would add the Board of Parole as a body to be consulted. We're also adding after line 44 a new section which would say that the Supreme Court has the authority to approve the form before it can be used by the trial court. Section 8 of the bill is existing law that has to do with the pre-sentence investigation report. We're proposing at line 5 to delete the bold-faced language. Information in the pre-sentence may be made available to the victims. The district attorneys have a bill in on that topic already. It's working its way through. There is no reason to create a conflict. We're not backing off the proposal. Theirs is, I think, more well-developed.
That was Senate Bill 1041 that we passed out. Do you know if that passed the House committee or not?
You may want to just do a conforming amendment, you know, one of the 8A options that LC does.
Sure. The other new language in Section 8 has to do with the proof of the criminal history. And again, this is an area where there's been substantial discussion between the DAs and the defense bar. What we are saying is, at line 27, we want to eliminate at or before the time of sentencing. There was some discussion that might mean on the day of sentencing all this information would have to be provided. We're proposing to return to what is current statutory language and say that the defendant has to notify the DA of any error in the criminal history prior to the date of the sentencing. That's what current law requires. So we're proposing an amendment at line 27. Section 9 is existing law about...
Yes, counsel. Ms. Bogan, what would be the effect if the defendant did, in fact, or didn't notify the state until the day of sentencing. If there were, in fact, a mistake in the criminal history.
If the statute required that it be submitted prior to the date and it were submitted on the date of sentencing?
Yes.
I'd ask Judge Aragon what happens when that happens. Does that ever happen?
We haven't gotten in, from my experience, to this particular type of an approach. And I don't have an answer.
Would it be a violation of due process to go ahead and sentence the defendant if in fact there were bona fide mistake in the criminal history?
I don't know whether there would be an appeal basis or not. I know that if a defendant did not take care of a responsibility like this, I would go forward. In other words, I would view that in order to be able to raise the particular point, that he would in fact have to comply with the procedural process. To my recollection, we haven't discussed this particular point, have we?
No.
I think as the judge perhaps has responded, although I don't want to read too much into his response, I think the court, absent clear direction, is going to exercise its own discretion, perhaps depending upon the circumstances as to whether or not the reason or cause for that failure to comply with the statute was within the control of the defendant or the defendant's attorney, or I guess there might be some concern that everyone's just going to go through a process that is going to be reversed or subject to review. I don't know if there's any further clarification that's appropriate in statute. Again, my sense is that judge, he or she, is just going to look at those circumstances.
I would think that would be right. For instance, if there were some sort of good cause shown, some sort of mix-up in communications or something, then obviously I think any judge would simply continue it for further hearing. On the other hand, if there wasn't any good cause, then I think that most judges would be prone to simply go ahead and say you should have done what it said here. You know, it's not going to affect this court's ability to be able to go forward and complete the sentencing.
Thank you.
I guess what you're saying is the remedy might be just to exercise some appropriate discretion and continue the sentencing hearing.
Which really we get involved in day-to-day matters. You know, this is not unlike many matters that we would face so far as what happens when something procedurally isn't done. There are a lot of sections that don't provide for some particular process, and that, as Senator Springer is discussing, is when we do use that discretion, and then, of course, if we use it improperly or arbitrarily, that, of course, could be contested and overturned.
Section 9 is existing law about finding aggravating and mitigating circumstances for sentencing. It adds new language that says under the guidelines, those findings will be made pursuant to the guidelines rules. You'll recall that they had two sections on aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Section 10 is an amendment to the existing statute about proof of aggravating and mitigating circumstances and makes specific what evidence the court will consider. My recollection is that this is basically a rearrangement of existing law and not a substantive change. Section 11 is again the effective date of the guidelines. It amends existing law and says that whenever a person is convicted of a felony committed on or after September 1st, that the sentence will be imposed in accordance with the rules. Section 12 of the bill has to do with consecutive sentences. 12 and 13 are the parallel statutes that appear in current law, one the result of the Crime Victims Initiative. And the first, Section 12, is the bill which, the law which preceded the Crime Victims Initiative. The change that we're making in Section 12 and 13 is on page 6. It's at line 10. And line 44, thank you, page 6. It changes an or to an and. It's a substantive change. It requires a finding that the criminal offense for which the consecutive sentence is being considered was not only incidental, but also that there was a substantially different harm. Do you have any?
Excuse me. Senator Spring. Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I recall, district attorneys had some concern about that. Has that been resolved? Or?
Senator Springer, I expected district attorneys to have some concern about it. It was not on the original list, and I'm sure that they do. It was not put to us as a major concern that they had. I asked early on if anyone could give me examples of cases that might fit the or test but not the and test. And we've talked about other, I think, more pressing issues to the DAs and have not resolved this one. I don't think it's irresolvable if they think it makes a huge difference in the law. I felt if they thought it made a huge difference in the law, we would have heard a great deal more about it. The DAs are here. I'm sure they're going to testify, if not today, on Wednesday. And
Kathleen, I wonder if it might be useful to mention that when we talked about the date just now, it sort of rang a bell with me, to mention that some of these amendments, if I'm not mistaken, are in response to the Attorney General's opinion. Did we discuss that already, and I just don't remember it? Or?
We didn't discuss it, and I haven't gotten to any of those amendments yet. And I'm not sure that the AG's opinion has been formally. I'd ask Mr. Wassman where we are with the AG's opinion.
Nodding his head, yes. I didn't mean to bring this up out of the right sequence. I just. We'll be getting to
it. I'm authorized to talk about the AG's. Yes, I will point out where there were some. The interesting thing is that the points raised in the AG opinion were raised also from other sources. So I was prepared to talk about them regardless. I'll do that. Section 14 on page 7 of the bill provides that when consecutive sentences are imposed under the guidelines, there is a maximum to the sentence that can be imposed, and it will be as provided by rule. The section 15 is simply, I believe, conforming language. It's existing law that has to do with release of a defendant from a county jail. This simply includes those defendants who are there because of being sentenced under the rules. You'll kick me if I'm wrong.